This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello from Stephen Crittenden. Welcome to the Religion Report. We faced a dilemma this morning. We had almost 50 minutes of material, but only 28 minutes to broadcast in the program. Among other things, I've got a lovely interview for you about Jack Straw and Muslim women wearing the veil, but we'll have to hold it over till next week. I think you'll understand why in a few minutes. A couple of weeks back, it was the Pope who apologised for upsetting Islam, and this week he's even gone so far as to alter the text of the lecture he delivered at Regensburg, adding in some nice remarks about Islam and the Quran. Well, now it's the turn of Dr. Amir Ali to apologise for offending Islam. It's been a difficult few days for Dr. Ali, who chairs the Prime Minister's Muslim Reference Group. Last week, in an interview in the Australian newspaper, he suggested that the Quran needed to be interpreted for a modern Australian context and that Muhammad of Mecca was a human being who was not perfect. The Mufti of Australia, Sheikh Hilali, responded by comparing Dr. Ali's remarks with Salman Rushdie and the Satanic Verses. We set our watches to wait for Dr. Ali's retraction, and lo and behold, by Monday, Dr. Ali was expressing regret for the offence that had been caused, affirming in a most humble manner that Islam and its prophet are perfect, and repeating the comments he made on this program a few weeks ago, that Australia is a Muslim country. I asked Dr. Ali whether it had been a difficult few days.
Indeed it was, yeah.
You say you were inundated by angry calls and emails.
Oh, lots of it. These are things to be expected once you are working for the community.
Well, tell us about that. What did they say?
Well, it's a mixed reception. In fact, you see, when you have a telephone conversation, you can't explain everything that you want to explain on certain delicate issues. So one has to be very careful. But once you go on talking to a journalist, some now and then certain words can slip through, and journalists, being what they are, they try to get the mileage out of those words, and that's what happened. And that was misunderstood by a lot of people, but some people understood what I said. So the matter is now, I think, cooling down.
Well, you say the comments attributed to you last week in The Australian were deeply offensive to all Muslims. Are you saying that the mistake in the article was made by you, or was it made by The Australian's journalist Richard Kabash?
No, I think the whole thing is a mixture there, because after all, some words come from me, some words put on by the journalist, so it's a mixed picture. I don't want to put blame on anybody, and if I have been sort of contributed something for this whole mishap, I take the blame for it.
Are you saying you got Islam wrong?
No, not at all. I still believe in my religion. Prophet is the most perfect model. But we don't want to go into all those details. Now we leave it at first moment.
Did you get any calls or emails from people to support you?
Yeah, some people said support my views, and lots of people don't agree with me. So that's fair enough. You can't expect 20 million people to agree with me on anything in this country.
It's their democratic right not to.
It's democratic, yes, exactly. They have their perfect right. They have the perfect right to criticize me if I'm wrong. And those who think that I'm right, okay, they'll telephone and say, okay, Dr. Ali, you have taken a good stand, and that's it. That's the end of the matter.
When the Mufti, Sheikh Hilali, criticized you last week, he compared your words to what Salman Rushdie said in the Satanic Verses. No, did you take that as a threat?
No. I met the Mufti. I explained to him what happened. Then he said, well, it's all media. Played it out, and he wanted to withdraw his comments after I spoken to him, but it was too late.
So you've withdrawn your comments, and he's withdrawn his.
The Mufti wanted to withdraw his comments about me soon after I explained to him on that very same day. But by the time he got in touch with the media people, it was too late. It had gone to the press.
Of course, there was a death sentence issued by the Ayatollah Khomeini against Salman Rushdie, wasn't there? That's what everyone remembers.
No. I think that is too... you can't go to that extent, I don't think. There's nothing of that sort in Australia.
Well, of course, there couldn't be, because I assume if there was, the person making a threat like that would find themselves pretty quickly arrested.
Let's not... I think... We have gone through this. I don't want to go over this once again.
Let me ask you this. Is it possible that what happened last week when you made your comments about the Quran and Muhammad is that, in a sense, you were thinking aloud and inventing your own Islam, because the real Islam, is difficult for Muslims in a country like Australia.
No, not at all. It's not. I'm not inventing anything. In fact, the Mufti agreed with me that as time moves on, we need to interpret things. And so it's an ongoing process. There's nobody invents anything in this. Islam is Islam. The Quran is there intact, and doctrine is all. It is there. You can only interpret it. You can't remove it, or you can't add to it. You can only interpret it.
So, what's your relationship with Sheikh Hilali now?
Very, very friendly. We are very close. That's it. I met him last night.
And what did he have to say?
I had dinner with him last night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in his house, in fact.
Everything's dandy.
Everything is dandy. There's nothing between us.
And what about your ongoing status in the Muslim community? Are you going to be, do you think, making up for those comments for some time to come?
My position is I'm an individual in the whole community. As long as the community trusts me and they believe me, I'll do whatever the community wants me to. I'll lead them. If they don't trust me, I'm out of it. That's it. It's a democratic country. Nobody has a divine right to lead any community in this country.
Thank you very much for being on the program yet again.
Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I had the peculiar sensation that I was interviewing two Dr. Alis there. This is the Religion Report on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and on your pod. I'm Stephen Crittenden. Well, now to Southeast Asia. Australia's highly respected Malaysia specialist, Professor Clive Kessler of New South Wales University, has a short but powerful piece due to be published any day now in the next issue of Asian Analysis at aseanfocus.com. It's entitled Malaysia, the Long March Towards Desecularisation. And Clive argues that a seismic shift is underway, with Malaysian society becoming more and more sectarian and the secularists and pluralists on the back foot. In fact, the progressive era may well be over. Well, Clive is always an honoured guest on this program, but this time when I phoned, he redirected me to Dr. Farish Noor, Malaysian specialist now teaching at the Zentrum Moderna Orient in Berlin. Among other things, Farish recently interviewed Abu Bakar Bashir in Indonesia. And he too paints a picture of increasing sectarianism in both Malaysia and Indonesia, and a process which has been described as creeping Sharia. Well, Farish Noor is on holiday in Paris this week with his wife, but he agreed to take some time off to talk to me. And I began by asking whether he agreed with Clive Kessler's picture of radical Islam capturing both of Malaysia's major political parties, PAS and UMNO, and progressive NGOs in the country increasingly being marginalised.
Not only would I agree with that, I think I would backdate that process going back to the 70s. I think what we are witnessing in Malaysia today is the natural development of something that began in the 70s when both UMNO and PAS were trying their best to, in a sense, engage in what I call the Islamization race in order to put to the fore their Islamic credentials rather than their national credentials, to basically out-Islamize each other, to both parties trying to demonstrate how committed they were to Islamic and Muslim concerns. This is obviously intended to bolster their support among the majority Malay Muslim constituency, but I think at the expense of marginalizing non-Malays and non-Muslims in the country.
And am I right in thinking that a very important moment in that process was when Dr. Mahathir, who of course is usually seen as a secularist sympathiser, amended the Malaysian law, I think in 1988, to raise the status of Sharia courts to being co-equal with the civil courts in Malaysia?
Well, that was one important event, but again, we have to put it in context. Throughout the 80s, we've seen a number of other initiatives, all of which were designed to basically place Islam firmly in the center of Malaysian domestic politics, and also to reorient Malaysia's foreign policy towards the Muslim world. Now, there are both internal and external reasons for this. The external factor was simply Malaysia looking for a broader coalition of partners that would support Malaysia's international initiatives. So the Muslim world was one obvious constituency that they had to appeal to. But domestically, we have to remember that the demographic factor is important. The expansion of the Malay Muslim constituency and the emergence of an urbanized Muslim middle class that I suppose Mahathir felt had to be co-opted into the state apparatus. So the elevation of the Sharia courts, for instance, can be read as that. It was an attempt to actually give equal status to these Malay Muslims that had been absorbed into the Malaysian civil service so that they did not feel alienated or marginalized within the state structure. But of course, the long-term result is that the state becomes dominated by Malay Muslims. Even if you look at the composition of the Malaysian civil service, which used to be more multiracial, today the Malaysian civil service and institutions like the Malaysian police and the Malaysian army are basically dominated by Malays.
Of course, there's a very important case going on at present, a constitutional case involving an ethnic Malay woman named Lina Joy, who has converted to Christianity and wants her papers changed to reflect that. There must be a lot riding on the outcome of that case. What do you think the outcome is likely to be?
Well, at this stage, because the case has become so politicized and it has become the cause célèbre of the Islamist opposition and the Islamist public sector, this is going to be perhaps one of the most controversial legal cases to be fought out in Malaysia today. What is interesting is that either way, the conservative Islamist lobby wins. If Lina Joy's conversion to Christianity is accepted and passed, then in a sense it gives many of these conservative Islamist organizations a pretext to say that the Malaysian state allows Muslims to leave Islam. If her appeal is not accepted, then they can claim a victory. So either way, they win, in a sense.
Just going back to the first of those scenarios, if she won, you're suggesting that would be a pretext for some kind of big disruptive campaign.
Oh, of course. I mean, let's look at this in context again. The number of Muslims converting to Christianity or going to other religions is extremely small in Malaysia. Most of the cases involve marriages. They involve non-Muslims who had converted to Islam because the Malaysian law forces them to convert to Islam if they marry a Muslim. And in many cases, these marriages don't work, and then they revert back to their original religions, which could be Hinduism, Buddhism, or Christianity. Now, it would be wrong to say that there is a concerted attempt to convert Muslims to Christianity in Malaysia. However, this is the scenario that is being painted by some of these conservative groups, again, to win support from the Malay Muslims and to sort of, you know, produce and reproduce a stereotypical conspiracy theory that somehow Islam and Muslims are under threat in their own country.
There's a debate going on within Malaysia just now, suggesting that Malaysia's Islam with a modern face is not at all the same as liberal Islam. And in fact, a conference was recently organised by Malaysia's Muslim Professional Forum under the very interesting and provocative title, Liberal Islam, a Clear and Present Danger.
Well, that is true, and I think the term liberal Islam is actually an interesting one because it has no roots in the Malaysian context. This is actually a term that was brought in from Indonesia because in Indonesia there exists a group of liberal Muslims who organize themselves under the banner of Islam Liberal.
So you're saying that the term liberal Islam isn't even one that's used by Malaysians?
No. I do not know of a single organization or individual in Malaysia that actually uses this term. But what the conference does show is that the cooperation between conservative Muslims in Malaysia and Indonesia is actually increasing to the point where, you know, similar themes, similar terms are now being shared by both sides. I think we are witnessing the emergence of a sort of pan-Malaysian Indonesian conservative religious front. And this would involve basically NGOs, movements, political parties that have been networking quite intensively for the past 10 years.
Right. So, I mean, one possibility is that the development of a more radical Islam in Malaysia and in Indonesia right next door is just a coincidence. Are you suggesting that they're coordinated in some way? And if so, by whom?
Well, they are definitely coordinated, and they're coordinated by the major actors and players in the religio-political scene. A lot of the coordination takes place in, you know, joint conferences and seminars that take place not only in Malaysia and Indonesia, but also in neighboring countries like Bangladesh and Pakistan. And there have been many of these conferences, particularly in the wake of September 11th, where more conservative Islamist parties and NGOs have been organizing meetings to discuss what they see as, you know, threats to the Muslim community worldwide. So a sense of global Muslim consciousness is definitely there. This is not necessarily a bad thing, but when the agenda is hijacked by, you know, more conservative forces that wish to use these, you know, conspiracy theories in order to set up a kind of hate machine directed towards other religious communities, then I think it does become problematic, particularly for countries like Malaysia with a multiracial, multireligious background.
I'm speaking to Dr. Farish Noor. He's on the phone from Paris. And you're listening, of course, to The Religion Report with me, Stephen Crittenden. Farish, I'm interested in what all this means for the political career of Dr. Mahathir's old foe, Anwar Ibrahim, who I've always thought of as an Islamist.
Well, I think at the moment, if we look at who Anwar is associated with, I think there are many who would argue that Anwar is actually much closer to the neocon establishment of the United States rather than the Islamists. In fact, simply judging by his public appearances and the places that he's been invited to speak, you would get the impression that the man is trying very much to get over his earlier image as an Islamist leader. So in a way, Anwar straddles both worlds. He's very much in contact with the American political establishment, and he has made this clear on several occasions, including during his recent visit to Australia. But at the same time, he also maintains links with the conservative Islamists. Now, this is, of course, highly problematic because the two groups do not see eye to eye on practically every issue, and it remains to be seen whether Anwar can actually play a mediating role in all this.
Yes, well, I was going to say the two poles, neocon and Islamist, that are very far apart, it must be very difficult for him to straddle those poles.
Well, it actually in the end depends on where Anwar wants to place himself. If he were to aspire to a position of political leadership in Malaysia, then certainly the Islamist lobby is one that he cannot afford to avoid for the reasons I've mentioned earlier. You know, the demographic shift would indicate that the emerging Malay Muslim constituency is a very powerful one. It's the biggest vote bank in the country, and you cannot afford to antagonize this vote bank. But having said that, within Malaysia itself, Anwar and his party are facing very real problems, shortages of funds, lack of media coverage, and so international support would be crucial to his campaign at this moment. So he's caught between a rock and a hard place, basically.
I want to come on and talk just very briefly about Abu Bakar Bashir in Indonesia in a moment. But one more question about Malaysia, and that is, I get letters from time to time mentioning the Sisters in Islam as a modernising group in Malaysia that's actually been very successful in recent years. But I'm reading in Clive Kessler's piece the suggestion that the groups like that, NGOs like that with a progressive face, really are being marginalised now.
Well, I would concur with that for one simple reason. I think, again, what we are witnessing in Southeast Asia is the emergence of a religiously inspired public sector, which would in the end, I think, create a sort of parallel Islamic civil society. You would notice that in Malaysia and Indonesia, over the past 2 years alone, there have been more than 24 new NGOs and lobby groups that have emerged. Many of these groups are opting to carry on the political struggle through non-political means, i.e. through civil society, through lobbying, through media campaigns, through public demonstrations. And what they are doing, in effect, is marginalizing the secular civil society in both countries. You mentioned earlier the Muslim Professionals Forum. I mean, this is basically a lobby group that involves professional Malaysians, but it is a sectarian one in the sense that its membership is exclusive to Muslims. So as we see more and more of these sectarian, communitarian movements appear in both countries, I think the secular civil society is going to become increasingly weakened, if not marginalised.
Now let's get on to Abu Bakar Bashir, who of course got out of prison recently in Indonesia. You interviewed him recently. What was it like to come face to face with the man?
Well, it was a very ambivalent and ambiguous experience because, of course, you know, Abu Bakar Bashir's reputation precedes him, and one is very much aware of the fact that you're talking to someone who understands very well the power of the media, knows how to use the media, and wants to get his message across. And there are two ways you can do an interview like that. I think it should be very clear to anyone who knows anything about Indonesia or knows how these organizations work that the mode of a critical interview would be very difficult, if not impossible, because the man is very adept to the workings of the media and knows how to deflect questions. So the other option was to do what I did, which is basically allow him to say whatever he wanted to say, and by doing so, get a better glimpse of the internal workings of the man and the group that he represents. And I think that was what we were trying to do.
It can be a very clever interview technique from time to time.
Yes, because I do believe that it is important to understand the mindset of such people. What fascinates me about Abu Bakar Bashir is not so much what he says, because I've been doing interviews with radical Islamists for the past 5 years now, and in fact, there were so many things that he said in that interview which reminded me of very similar statements made by leaders of similar profile in Malaysia, in southern Thailand, in Pakistan, in India. I've heard it all before. What is interesting, therefore, is the commonality of worldview that is shared by people like them. The other thing that's interesting is to see how this language has not changed over the past 20 years. And here is the important point that we need to emphasize. Abu Bakar Bashir has not said anything new. He's been saying exactly the same things since 1985. The difference is, in 1985, he was an unknown character. Today, he is a public figure, which means that public perception has shifted in his favor. And that, I think, is the question that, you know, analysts and political scientists like me are trying to answer.
Well, indeed. Let me quote what you say in the article. 30 years ago, Bashir would have said the same things as he does now, but his would have been a lonely voice in the wilderness. Not so now and not in the future. The moderates have not even begun to spell out an alternative vision that could match Bashir's and offer the same promise of hope and restoration that he has. In a desert of broken dreams, betrayed ambitions and fallen heroes, men like Bashir walk the earth like heroes. You're basically saying there that Abu Bakar Bashir is now the man of the future. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that as long as the structural and economic problems of Indonesia are not addressed effectively, and as long as Indonesia, I know, suffers under the poor leadership of leaders who don't have a concrete long-term vision for the country's future, it is this uncertainty that gives Bashir's language, his discourse, the sort of fixity and stability that people need. It's very interesting when I went, because you see, for me, the interview with Bashir was not the important one. It was the daily interviews done with people in the street who spoke very highly of the man, and again and again, the same refrain was given. He is consistent. He is consistent. People like you and I may be terrified of his vision of the future, but he does have a vision, at least. And here, I think, you know, we need to understand the complex dynamics of leadership. I mean, leadership is when someone takes the initiative and says, this is the solution to all your problems. Follow me and everything will be fine. Bashir is doing that. He offers a very black and white vision of the future.
How important is it, Farish, whether it's Hamas in Palestine, whether it's Abu Bakar Bashir and his organization in Indonesia, whether it's some of these new NGOs coming through in Malaysia, if they're able to satisfy people's needs for services, that you actually have a self-reinforcing system developing and people are coming for their health care and for all sorts of other things, that if they're able to establish an alternate Islamic civil society, that this actually is really going to lock in radical Islam in the future.
Well, you know, it will be locked in the sense that it will be institutionalized. I visited Indonesia, Yogyakarta and Solo this year after the earthquake. And I've also visited Kashmir earlier this year after the earthquake in Pakistan-controlled Kashmir. In both cases, you know, the Islamist groups were the first on the scene, and they are the only ones who remain on the scene. The international aid agencies came and went, the donor agencies came and went, but the Islamists are there because they realize that's their constituency. And it's their ability to root themselves and to give out public services in a very public way and to entrench themselves, which has somehow embedded them in the context of these places. So in a way, groups like Majlis Mujahideen Indonesia have now become permanent fixtures. And you know, the other thing about these groups is that they have a very broad spectrum of concerns, i.e. they are there not only to preach, but they also provide basic services, health, education, welfare, and they do it consistently on the basis of voluntarism. And I suppose this is a lesson for a lot of the liberal moderates and the secular moderates, that unless and until they are prepared to actually commit themselves in the long run the way these Islamists are going to do, there is no way that they're going to be able to win over support on a local level. I see, I'm very skeptical about many of the activities conducted by the urban-based liberals and moderates, because they seem to be engaged in so many of these international conferences that take place in New York or Geneva or Paris. But, you know, you're not needed there. You're needed in your own country. You're needed on the ground in places like Aceh after the tsunami, or in Jogja after the earthquake, or in Kashmir after the earthquake. And that's where you have to be there permanently. You have to show your face. You have to be there to establish face-to-face contact with people who need you. The strength of Abu Bakr Bashir's group is that they are there on a daily basis. They don't leave. They actually stay there. They root themselves there. And after the calamity has been dealt with, they're permanently installed.
Okay, a final question. Okay. A process of desecularization in Malaysia, certainly similar forces percolating around in Indonesia. What are the foreign policy implications for Australia?
Foreign policy implications. Well, I think for a start, we need to get over our own cultural hang-ups vis-a-vis the question of religion and Islam in particular. I think so many of the problems we face at the moment is that, you know, we approach people like Abu Bakr Bashir through a very jaundiced lens. I mean, I will state clearly that my own position is completely radically opposed to what the man represents. But, you know, a certain degree of objective distance is required.
Well, you'd have to admit too, wouldn't you, that Australians have got every reason to be jaundiced. Most Australians believe he was directly responsible for the murder of the victims at Bali.
I agree with that. But the thing is, you see, it's not the man himself. This question was asked to me before. Would it not be better to put the man in jail or keep him in jail? Well, the problem is, as I said, if his discourse has become hegemonized in Indonesia, then him being in jail makes no difference. The thing is, Abu Bakr Bashir's ideas have now become popular. And that's what we've got to deal with. We need to understand how and why there has been this shift to a register that is more sectarian, more communitarian, and even more radically violent. And I think the contribution that other countries, be it Australia, Malaysia, Singapore, I think the contribution that we can play vis-a-vis the internal problems of Indonesia is to help Indonesia actually sort out its political and economic, particularly economic problems, because it's this state of economic and political uncertainty that is actually helping Abu Bakr Bashir and people like him maintain their position in society. It would be a very different Indonesia today if the international community had made a concerted effort to help Indonesia get back on its feet immediately after the 97-98 crisis. You know, take into account the very simple fact that the Indonesian economy has not really recovered. It's been almost 10 years now. So what do you expect? I mean, I live in Germany, I work in Germany, and of course, you know, German history tells us that, you know, in a state of economic and political crisis, the groups that are favored by this state of uncertainty are the most radical and extreme. That's how Hitler came to power. And in the same way that, you know, the countries of Europe should have helped Germany get back on its feet after World War I, likewise, I strongly believe that the best way to deal with the problems of Indonesia today is to help the economy recover, to work towards more transparency, more democratic accountability, and to bolster the institutions of civil society, rather than to allow, you know, the process of globalization to weaken the economy even further. A weak Indonesian economy, an unstable Indonesian political system, is going to be the thing that helps Abu Bakar Bashir and people like him more than anything else.
Stunning interview, Farish. Thank you very much for being on the program.
All right.
Great to talk to you.
Okay.
Weimar, Indonesia. There you are. Dr. Farish Noor of the Zentrum Moderna Orient in Berlin. Well, that's all this week. You can get a transcript of the program on our website at abc.net.au/religion. And we'll also point you to some of the articles we've been speaking about in today's program. Thanks this week to our producers, Emma Hoff-Williams and Louis Mitchell. I'm Stephen Crittenden. See you next week.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.